we'll go ahead and get started with our lesson tonight. And I found it. You know what I'm talking about, don't you? The missing lesson. Oh, I did find it. What I'm going to do is take this up from this from the time that Abraham had gone down into Egypt, and just, you know, quickly go over these slides in review. So here he goes down into Egypt, and remember the story with Pharaoh down there that we've been over. And then he goes back, and when he goes back to Bethel and Ai, where he had been before, where he built the altar before. You know, he had been at Shechem and then Bethel heading south, and he built the altar both places, and now he goes back to that spot. And right there, Bethel and Ai, just a little north of the site of Jerusalem, and back where he had built that altar before. And remember, we told the story then that he and Lot were very, very wealthy. They were so wealthy that they didn't really have enough for their herds and flocks. So their herdsmen were quarreling with each other about the grass and the water and everything like that. So Abraham came to him and said, look, we be brethren. We're brethren. We shouldn't be fussing. Our herdsmen should not be fussing like this. So you look left, right, north, south, wherever you want to look. You choose it. I'll go the other direction. And so Lot looked and he saw from up here at Bethel, he looked down to the southern end of the Dead Sea. And remember, I told you that at that time, the southern end of the Dead Sea did not look as it looks today. And I'll give you a hint, it didn't look as it looked after Genesis 19. That's when the big change came. And we'll study that when we get there. But Lot moved down there toward Sodom and Gomorrah. So notice that in 13:12 it says Lot pitched his tent toward Sodom, down toward the south end of the Dead Sea. And notice this ominous statement in 13:13. But the men of Sodom were wicked and sinners before the Lord exceedingly. Do all of you see how in the writing of the story here, the narrator could have waited till later to put that in? But he wants us to know now that there's trouble coming, you see. So he tells us that, and we will see in chapter 19 that they were exceedingly wicked. And then by the time we get to chapter 14 and verse 12, Lot is dwelling in Sodom, which illustrates the progressive nature that sin has. If you begin to give way, and not only if you're deliberately giving way, but if you are inadvertently giving way, and you're doing something that you shouldn't be doing because you haven't thought about it. Whatever the reason is, once you begin to compromise and accommodate sin, it will never have enough. It will never have enough. The devil will never have enough. So this progression here shows that. So by the time the story in chapter 14 occurs, Lot is going to be living in the city of Sodom. Now, God said to Abraham, I want you to rise up. I want you to travel up and down and all over this land. For all the land which thou seest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed forever. Does anybody have trouble telling now what promise this was? All right, yeah, that's the land promise. And I will make thy seed as the dust of the earth. But now notice that as the dust of the earth has to do with the number of Abraham's descendants and so on, and therefore has to do with the nation promise, not the spiritual blessing promise. And so what we have here in chapter 13, verses 15 and 16 are two of the promises, the land and the nation. Okay, now, what time did I tell you Abraham lived? Just a rough figure. It starts with 2000. That's right. You got it now, right? 2000, middle of the night, flashlight in the face. You know when it is. 2000 B.C. All right, now the reason why I'm asking you that is, how long do we have to look over these promises, and or how long do we have to observe them, and God oversees the coming of these promises? How long will that be? 2,000 years he's going to be bringing this to pass. So would that be within the lifetime of one man so that he could do all the writing and see that it was all taken care of? Would one man be able to do that? Well, how in the world could all these different men do that? It was inspired. They were told by God. So remember that here we see the land and the nation promise repeated. So Abraham rises up and he heads to the south and he comes down to live at Mamre, which was in the vicinity of Hebron. You'll find both Mamre, Hebron, and Kiriath Arba all used as reference in referring to that same area, that same place. So, as I told you the last time, for 12 years, the kings Amraphel, Arioch, Chedorlaomer, and Tidal, kings of Mesopotamia, held control over the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah, the southern end of the Dead Sea, Bera, Bersha, Shinab, Shemeber, and the king of Zoar. So these were the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah and the area round about. So these were the kings of Mesopotamia and the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah, and they had held them under their control. These kings coming from the area of Mesopotamia over there to the general area, and it wasn't just one little area. They had held control over this whole region, more or less, and so they had held control of these nations and kings there, and they had rebelled against them. And they rebelled in the 13th year, and in the 14th year, these kings of Mesopotamia got their forces together. And they came over, and they came down on the east side of the Jordan, and they conquered the peoples over there, subdued them. They came on down into what later would be, even though that map has Edomites on it, the Edomites don't live there yet. They won't live there yet until in our story we get to the days of Jacob and Esau and after that, because the other name for Edom is Esau, okay? But that's the region. It was called Mount Seir. So he comes down, these kings come down to Mount Seir all the way down, see? So they're just conquering everything they come to over there, and also over toward the wilderness of Paran and Kadesh. And so you see how ultimately they're just cleaning up all the way around the south and all on the east side there, so that they're going to be able then to concentrate their efforts on fighting with the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah. So they join battle. And when they join battle, they defeat these kings of Sodom and Gomorrah. And they take the captives and they take the loot, they take everything, and they flee. And I say flee, they're not really fleeing. They're just heading back home. They're just heading back home. Well, meanwhile, one of the men escapes from the battle, and he makes his way up to Mamre. Because somehow, he either knows that Abraham is there, or he just happened to choose that way. I would rather think that he knew that there was a powerful chieftain that lived over in that area. At any rate, whatever he did go that route, he comes up there and he tells Abraham what has happened. So Abraham gets 318 trained men of his own house, plus he gets Mamre, Aner, and Eshcol. These were three men who lived in the vicinity of Mamre. See, the Mamre there is named after, in fact, instead of saying that Mamre is named after the other Mamre, I think that the man was named Mamre because his family name had been associated with that city for some time. So this Mamre is associated, he would be associated with a ruling family there. And of course this wouldn't be a great big kingdom of some kind. It was just a city state, and a little one at that. It was not much more than a settlement here instead of a walled city or something like that. So there's Mamre, Aner, and Eshcol, and all three of them have men at their disposal. So they get together with Abraham and they pursue. So they pursue these kings that are proceeding up the east side. That'd be following the king's highway, which would be a very convenient way for them to go. And so they're just heading back, and they have no idea that there is a strong force that has been assembled that is after them. Now, Abraham and his confederates know that they're going to have to be stealthy about this. They're going to have to use every advantage in order to win the day. So as they get on farther north, you can see there where Laish is and Dan. That may be the Dan just named there in view of what it would later be, not because at the time it was called Dan. It wasn't called Dan at the time. And there was another place or two that you can read about that was a Dan, but I don't know which one it was. But it could have been this one right here, just named in view of the fact that later on it would be called that. But when they divided themselves up and they attacked, they made a surprise attack, and the enemy fled, leaving everything, leaving all of the loot, and leaving the captives, leaving them all behind. So Abraham recovered all of the goods and all of the people. So I'm sure they were greatly relieved and were very thankful to have accomplished that. So they began then to head back. Abraham and all of his company there, they all began to head back home now. And from that, from Dan there down to Beersheba was 150 miles. So they've got several miles to go to get there, and they'll have to, you know, take their time. So they're heading on south, and as they head south, they eventually come to the vicinity of Salem, which is short for Jerusalem. So they come there, and there is a man who comes out to meet them, Melchizedek, who is king of Salem. He is the priest of God Most High. And he comes out to meet them, and he brings bread and wine. And as he comes out to meet them, I want to go over some of the information that we looked at with regard to Melchizedek. So here is a more blown-up map where Salem is, where Melchizedek was king, and so on. So Melchizedek, first of all, the term itself, Melchizedek, is from Melchi or Melek, meaning king, and then Zedek is righteousness. King of Salem, the word Salem means peace. So if you interpret the names, the titles of this man, then it would be saying he was the king of righteousness, he was the king of peace, and he was priest of the Most High God. Now, we're going to say some more about that in just a moment and stress some things. Now, this is in chapter 14. We're in Genesis 14 as we're looking at these thoughts. There was no genealogy given of Melchizedek. And that doesn't mean he didn't have one, but it means that it was unimportant to the story. It was unimportant to his being priest. And that's the point that is going to be used of Melchizedek later on, that he was a special priest, specially chosen of God, regardless of what his genealogy was. So he was a man that God wanted to be priest because he wanted him to be priest, not because he was of the right family or something like that. Therefore, there's no record of his birth. That doesn't mean he wasn't born. It's just meaning that in the record, there's no story about that. That's not emphasized. There's no record of his death. Of course, later on, you know, we could have said, oh, there's this old guy over here. He claims he was Melchizedek. And well, no, there's nobody that shows up later on like that. So there's no reason to think that he wasn't born. No reason to think that he didn't die. Those are not the points that are made. The point is that in the record, there's nothing said about that. Therefore, it was unimportant to his priesthood. These things had nothing to do with his priesthood. Now, in this way, he is a foreshadowing of the coming of Christ. Sometimes in the Bible, you have a foreshadowing in the sense of what we call a type. You have a type and an antitype. But I prefer to use the idea of prophecy. So here you have someone. Let me just illustrate. You know, I love to use just figures like this, this foreshadowing. The Bible talks about a shadow of the things to come, you know, in Hebrews. Well, it's like this. Suppose we were standing on this side, and there's a corner. And there's a corner. And there's someone coming, and he's coming this way, and I can't see him yet. Or I can't see what it is yet. Standing around the corner here, I can't see him. But before I can see him, the light is right, I can see a shadow. The shadow gives me some indications about what this is going to be. But I can't see it as clearly as when I eventually see the real thing. So do you see that? So in the Bible, a lot of times we have a situation where you have a kind of a shadow of someone who in many important ways is just exactly the way this later important being is going to be himself. And so in this way, Melchizedek is a foreshadowing of the Christ who is to come. This is Jesus, the Messiah, in Hebrews 7, verses 1 through 3. In that chapter, he is called, Jesus or Melchizedek is called King of Righteousness and King of Peace and Priest of the Most High God. And the point is made that this is true of Jesus. This is exactly true of Jesus as well. And thus these qualities in Melchizedek foreshadow what Jesus himself would be. And furthermore, note the point, his genealogy did not make him priest. Once again, you see how that's true of Jesus. His genealogy did not make him priest. Now then, I probably have it on here, but let me go ahead and ask you, what tribe would Jesus had to have been of to be priest in Israel? Levi. What tribe was he of? Judah. Now, his being of the tribe of Judah was necessary for him to be the king, because David was of Judah and Jesus was to be the son of David, the descendant of David who would sit upon the throne. That meant he had to be of Judah, and he was. But he was not of Levi. So you couldn't say, oh, well, Jesus just became priest because he inherited it from his forefather. No, he did not. He definitely did not. Well, then you say, well, did Melchizedek inherit it from his forefathers? No, there's nothing said about that. Nothing said about a genealogy. He was priest because he was so special that God wanted him to be priest. Jesus would be so special, God would want him to be priest enough that he would pull out all the stops to get him there. Even if he had to change what? Even if he had to change the law. And that's exactly what he did. Notice also in Hebrews 7:16, why don't we get our Bibles open here? There are several verses that I want us to look at tonight. So let's start out here with Hebrews 7:16, and I want you to notice this. Hebrews 7:16. Donald, are you at that? Okay, read that, please.
Who has become such not on the basis of a law of physical requirement, but according to the power of the indestructible life.
Now this is Jesus. He has become the priest after the power of an endless life. Now we're going to keep that in mind. The Hebrew writer was not the first to use Melchizedek as a shadow of the high priest to come. The first to use that was the writer of Psalm 110 and verse 4. And you know who that is, David. Where he wrote, "Thou art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek." Now, I want you to study that. Those verses that are on the board there, that number one point up there. Do you see this endless life thing? Do you see this word right here? So even back there in Psalm 10 verse 4, he had the endless life thing, the forever thing. You, not a string of you, but you will be priest forever. How could Jesus do that? Well, we'll notice. No, we won't either. We're going to go back because I didn't know whether I had that point on there or not. Sometimes I have so many of them, I didn't remember which one it was. I didn't remember whether I had it up there or not. What would keep a man from being able to be priest forever? He would have to die. So how could Jesus be priest forever if he didn't begin to be priest until what? After his resurrection. And after his resurrection, then what does Jesus have? Right there. He has an endless life. So by the power of an endless life, he is able to fulfill that promise that was stated by David 1,000 years before Jesus. You are a priest forever. And so, after the order of Melchizedek. All right, so there are several things here then that we see in connection with this. Let me go now to the next slide. In Hebrews 7, 6 and 7, notice that. Hebrews 7, verses 6 and 7. Paul, how about reading that one? Now you have to take a little time to think about that. All right, read the first verse 6 again, Paul, please.
But he whose genealogy is not derived from that have received tithes from Abraham to bless him who had the promises.
Now, his genealogy, that is Melchizedek's genealogy, was not derived from them, meaning from Levi. But nevertheless, what does it say there? He received tithes, and what else? He blessed Abraham. Now verse 7, Paul.
Now beyond all contradiction, the lesser is blessed by the better.
In other words, the one who is in a position, either physically or spiritually, to bless another is the one who does the blessing. Not the one who does not possess that capacity, blessing the other one. So what does that argue in reference to Abraham and Melchizedek at this meeting? Who is superior in some sense? Melchizedek, because he blessed Abraham. And instead of Abraham saying, I don't want to be blessed. No, Abraham is saying, he shows great respect to this man. What is one of the greatest evidences of that respect that he showed Melchizedek? He gave him tithe. And the Hebrew writer, we won't read the rest of these particular verses, but if you go on reading after that, he is saying that at the time Abraham did this, within the loins of Abraham were Isaac and Jacob and Levi. So that if the father, the fountain of the family, you might say, the head, the fountain of the family, who included all those that came from him, if he paid tithes to Melchizedek, then what position did that put Levi in? He paid tithes also. In other words, if Levi had been there at that time, then by rights, what should he have done? Pay tithes to Melchizedek. So that the Hebrew writer is, again, notice, he's not inventing this. Now, where does he get that information right there from? Right back there in Genesis 14, it states it. It states that Melchizedek blessed Abraham. And it states right back there in Genesis 14 that Abraham gave tithes to him. And notice that the text itself says, in other words, it wasn't Abraham giving his opinion. It was the writer of the book of Genesis who says He was priest of God Most High, Genesis 14, verse 8. And when Abraham gave tithes to him, he acknowledged Melchizedek's priesthood. So you see, there may be a tendency for us to say that the later writers sort of made up a few things, a few neat ideas about Melchizedek. No, they didn't make it up. Because when you go back and read the facts are there. And they're exactly like these later writers pointed out. So, Abraham showed him respect and he acknowledged his priesthood. That means that priesthood was not a pagan priesthood. Do you all see that? That was not a pagan priesthood. By the way, this is an example of one who was a Gentile, so far as we know. He was a Gentile. He was not, certainly not of Abraham's seed. And yet he was a faithful servant of God, as Job was. Job's another one. Robert, did you have a question there? Well, right. The only thing that I can say is that I believe that the point is being made using figurative language. Just because the text does not record any of those events about him, that so far as the text is concerned, we never read about the death of Melchizedek. Now, that's the reason why, in a sense, he has an endless life. In the case of Jesus, it was because he was raised from the dead, never to die again. So, you've either got that, or you have this Melchizedek. That I really don't know anything more about him. Because if he didn't indeed die, then he must have been taken up from the earth, or, you know, I don't know. Did you have a comment? Okay. Sometimes I can tell. And sometimes I can tell when Robert has a comment, too. So, but I always appreciate that. And so, here is a man who becomes a prophetic type of Jesus. And these points are so interesting. So the king of Sodom says, Abraham, now you can keep all the loot. Just give me back the people. Wasn't that generous when Abraham had the army? You know, I've always thought it funny when a captive or somebody that doesn't have an army to his name, he's being real generous with everything. Well, yeah. So he's being real generous about this, but it's really interesting that Abraham says, I lifted up my hand, I swore to God that I would not take one thing, I wouldn't even take a shoestring from you, because I don't want anybody saying that the king of Sodom made Abraham rich. Now, do you get the idea there that Abraham considers king of Sodom one of the finest fellows you'd ever meet? I don't get that idea. Yeah, that's right. All right, so, yeah, that's right. So, the king of Sodom says that, but Abraham says, no, I'm not going to take a bit of it. He did not want the king of Sodom saying that he had made Abraham rich. So he gave a tithe to Melchizedek. But the rest of the thing, the only thing he said was, let men who are with me, their young men, let them take their expenses out of it. Mamre, Aner, and Eshcol, let them take their expenses out of it. That was all. So Lot has been brought back. And let me just say that it's kind of strange to me how people do. You would think that Lot might think, man, what an experience I've had. I think I'm going to... What would you think, Steve? I think I'm going to... Yeah, I think I'm going to head for other parts. Because this was terrible and it was so close. You know, but I have observed that in life, close calls rarely convert anybody for long. Close calls rarely convert anybody for long. Because close calls have to do primarily with the emotion of what? Fear. And fear doesn't last. When you take the thing that is frightening away. So Lot goes back. And there he is. And he stays there. And then we're going to see what happens to him in chapter 19. And it's not a pretty picture. And I want to keep that before you as we go along. Remember what Lot was. And in 2 Peter chapter 2, he is referred to as a righteous man. That righteous man vexed his soul in beholding the things he saw in Sodom and Gomorrah. He's a good man, a righteous man. But we're going to watch what happens to him by the time we get to chapter 19. Now, in this story that we encounter as we go into chapter 15, the promise becomes a covenant. So far, remember the three promises we've been talking about. I'll make of you a great nation. I'll bless all nations through your seed, and I'll give you the land of Canaan. I'll give that to your descendants also. Now God makes a covenant, not just a promise, but a covenant. We might put it this way: God signs contract. So you say, well, what's the difference? Well, you know what the difference is between a promise and a contract. The contract is much more assured than a promise is. Now, in fact, the Hebrew writer makes the point that when God makes a promise, it's as good as a contract. But what God did was to assure Abraham, he just went even the second step. I'm going to sign a contract. Now, why would God do that? Because he's wanting Abraham to have the very firmest foundation for his faith. So, at this time, we're not sure, but I think that the best figuring, it was probably close to... The text mentions that Abraham had been in the land 10 years, but that statement is not made so that we can be absolutely positive that it had been 10 years since Abraham had been there when this next story involving Hagar occurs. But I think it was about that. I think that's a good estimation. The 10 years is stated in the text. How long it had been since God appeared to Abraham, and was there any interval between the time God appeared to him and between the time that Sarah suggested that he go into Hagar? I don't know exactly how the time would work out there. But I do know that at the time that Abraham goes into Hagar, it's been 10 years. That makes him what? He was 75. Now he's 85. And so by the time Ishmael is born, he'll be approximately 1 year older. He'll be 86. Okay. But before we get to that point, now here Abraham is. Now see, a lot of us get the idea that Abraham was just every day God would come, you know, and he'd come in, God, how are you today? And they'd sit down and have this chat and everything. Well, the fact is, he would go years without hearing anything from God. There wasn't just constant chatter between him and God. So as you think about, oh, I wish I could be Abraham, well, I like to study my Bible a little more than every 3 or 4 years. And so I enjoy having my Bible so that I can just meditate and just soak myself in God's Word anytime I want to. I consider that to be a very, very great blessing. So Abraham had gone a while without seeing God. Also, he had gone a while without having a son. Now, what's he going to have for all these promises? Through your seed, to your seed, I'm going to do this. What's he going to have? He's going to have a child. He doesn't have a one. So when God shows up this time, it's just a little amusing to me. It's almost like Abraham is just, He's just been waiting, just waiting. And so when God says, Abraham, I am your exceedingly great shield, your strength and your exceedingly great shield. You know, oh, Abraham, oh, Lord, I know, and I am so glad. I really appreciate that. You know, I know that you're that way. And do you see, we're back in Genesis 15, by the way. Do you see that doesn't happen? Chuck, what does he say there? 15:1. So, Abraham has this on his mind. Lord, what are you going to do? Seeing I'm childless. Do you mean for my for Eliezer of Damascus to be my heir? In other words, his chief steward. Do you intend for him to be my heir? And God says, no, Abraham. One who is born to you out of your own body will be your heir. Oh, okay. So, it's not going to be somebody like Eliezer. No. Then notice in your Bible there, probably I've got it right up here, but I like you to look. Abraham sees no way for God's promise to be fulfilled at this point because he has no child. And so, I didn't have it. So let's look at that next verse. What does God tell Abraham to do? Steve, can you, Steve? Boy, we're getting a bunch of Steves, you know that? 15:5. All right, that's good right there. Brought him outside. Said, now, count the stars. Well, sometimes in our modern day, it'd be easy. There's one over there and another one over there, and maybe one up there, and that's about it. But if you have ever seen those clear nights when there was no light around, have any of you ever seen that very much? You know, back years ago, we didn't have security lights. I guarantee you where we lived, it was kind of the home of darkness. And I'm telling you, I remember that I went to college and I brought a boy back with me from Illinois, somewhere up there, one of those places. And he was a city boy. And so he went with me out here to the outback of Georgia. And we got out there, and I mean, I remember that it looked like, I've used the example that suppose that you had this great big black velvet thing, sheet up here, and somebody had just taken flour and just went like that. It was amazing. So if you were confronted with that, as Abraham would have been here in the highlands there, in that high, very high country around Hebron, count the stars. What would he have had to immediately say? No way. No way. It'd be similar to taking somebody down the seashore and saying, okay, sit in here and count all the grains. Actually, God uses the sand of the sea and the stars of the heaven both as the idea of how many descendants you're going to be. So, Steve, there in the last of the verse, he said, what? So what? See that? So shall your seed be. Now, here's one man. He has no children. None. Now, Jimmy, what does it say in verse 6? He believed the Lord. Abraham, how can you believe the Lord? I mean, how can you believe you're going to have children like that? The Lord said it. The Lord said it. So, I want to notice now something with you. He believed in the Lord, and he counted it to him for righteousness. Now that expression, Genesis 15 and verse 6, before I go on any further, let me ask my technician timekeeper. What, we got 5 minutes? All right, this is great. All right, now notice some things real quick here. Turn to Romans 4, 1 through 10, and we're going to just notice real quickly the highlights of Romans 4, 1 through 10 in view of this verse. Romans 4, 1 through 10, and I'm going to have some of it on the screen, but you'd want to have it. All right, in Romans 3, 20, as a little preliminary, look at what Paul writes. By the deeds of the law there shall no flesh be justified in his sight. So, what did God do? Notice, we conclude that a man is justified by faith without the deeds of the law. So, God prepared a way for a man to be justified without the deeds of the law. Since we can't be justified by the works of the law, then what did God do? He prepared a way we could be justified without the works of the law, meaning without being perfect. Now, the Judaizers commonly taught that unless a Gentile was circumcised, he could not be saved. Acts 15 and verse 1 says that. That's literally what it says. All right, now in this passage here in Romans 4, as Romans 4 begins, what did Abraham experience in the flesh? Was he perfectly sinless? Remember the Egypt episode? Remember that? I mean, you don't need more than that. How then was he justified? By being perfect? No. The answer does not originate in the New Testament. Do you see? Again, this is a point that I really like to emphasize. The point does not originate in the New. Paul sees this and makes this point, but he's going back. Where is this point made? Genesis 15, 6. Right back there in the story. And Abraham believed God, and it was counted unto him, or reckoned unto him, for righteousness. Okay? By his trust in God, not his perfect works, he was justified. But now continue thinking about this. When was this righteousness conveyed to Abraham? You know, here in Genesis 15, 6. Was it before circumcision or after circumcision? So if it was before it, then it was also what? Without it. So what about the Judaizing teachers saying, oh no, you got to be circumcised or you can't be saved. What about Abraham? What about Abraham? See, that just shot that down in flames. There was no way you could argue that unless you wanted to argue that your forefather Abraham wasn't saved. And which Jew would have wanted to do that? You know. And therefore, he was justified by his faith before the law and before circumcision. Do you see what that would have done to the Judaizing teachers' efforts? All right, now look in Galatians 3, 1 through 16. In verses 2 and 5, Paul says, did the blessing shared by the Galatian Christians come upon them by the law or by the hearing of faith? And of course, the answer is, it was by the hearing of faith. In other words, they had been around the synagogues and the Jews all these years and nothing had happened. But now the gospel comes to them and suddenly some really big things are happening. How did these changes come about? Look at verse 6 now. See that? Galatians 3 and verse 6. Abraham believed in God and it was counted to him for righteousness. They who trust in God. Now see, this is 3:7. They who trust in God are regarded as the children of Abraham, heirs of the blessing given to him. And what was the blessing given to him? Righteousness. Now, as a child of Abraham, how can I get that blessing? You know, but we'll see. God planned long ago to share the blessing of Abraham, righteousness, with the Gentiles. The scripture, foreseeing that God would justify the heathen through faith, preached before the gospel unto Abraham, saying, "In thee shall all nations be blessed." This is the seed promise. This is the spiritual blessing promise. In thee shall all nations. So what would all be? And be all of them. Gentiles, Jews, see, all of them. God had planned that. So then they which be of faith are blessed with the faithful Abraham. How do we become children of Abraham? By having the faith that he had. See that? And that is the beautiful point that he makes here. In Romans 4, 16 and 17, Paul explains how Abraham is the father of us all. As it is written, "I have made thee a father of many nations." So as you think about that promise right there, the nation promise, "I've made you a father of many nations," do you see that we've actually got two promises, the spiritual blessing promise and the father of many nations promise? Both of those have spiritual applications. See that? Because for him to be the father of many nations, that includes, well, you know, do you think the Edomites and the Israelites, and yeah, we can go on naming them, but is that all of it? Because otherwise, Paul would not be using that to say he's the father of us all. Because Abraham wouldn't have been the physical father of the Romans. So how would he be the father of any Romans? If some of the Romans believed and shared the faith of Abraham. So it's the idea, he's the father of all who believe. Well, now to Abraham and his seed were the promises made. He saith not, "And to seeds as of many, but as of one, and to thy seed, which is Christ." The promise that was made to Abraham and his seed, which was Christ. And I believe that the idea there is that the promise was made to Abraham. It says that. And to his seed, which was Christ. And included the people that went from Abraham down to Christ. But the promise was ultimately fulfilled in Christ and could be ultimately fulfilled in no one else. So, I know we went over that last part there a little bit fast, but the thing I want you to see is Genesis 15:6. This is two of the places it's quoted in the New Testament. We'll notice another one later. But now I hope you're impressed with how the writers of the New Testament are just going back here and getting spiritual treasures which are already back there. And that's really amazing to me.